Recording on. Welcome everyone to the Arizona State Hospital Independent Oversight Committee meeting. It's January the 16th, 2025, and it is 6:02, and we have met quorum. We have Kim, Kay, Chuck, Barb, Melissa, and we expect Janina and myself so far. And with that, is there any welcome, and does anyone have any conflict of interest that they need to disclose, any of the committee members? Okay, hearing none, let's go ahead and begin. Has everyone had a chance to review the meeting minutes? I know they're a little tedious since they're AI, but they were sent out by Larry, about a week ago?
Yes.
And okay.
Lori, I didn't receive a copy.
Sorry, Kay. I see
he
Tara.
Did, and I did review them.
Okay. Okay, so do we have a motion to pass either as is or with edits?
I motion to approve the minutes as is, unless someone wants discussion.
I second it.
Okay, Barb second. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Anyone opposed? So the meeting minutes passed for last month. So first, let's start with an update from ADOA.
Good evening. The only update I have for the committee tonight would be that we were able to hire an ombudsman for the state hospital. I'm not sure on the start date yet. Might be next week. I'm not exactly sure on that, but we do have somebody to fill that position, and which is good news. So probably have a more yes. Okay.
I just have a quick question. Will we be given this person's name and a way to contact that person? Will we be getting that information as patients?
No, okay. I believe that's going to be more of an admin position. That's going to be working more with with Michael and Trevor and and their teams on projects that are going on within the hospital. So there's going to be more to come on this, but as it stands now, I don't believe so.
Okay.
But we'll have more of a solid update for you next month once the person gets on the ground and I can have a name for the group and all that good stuff. So, but at least we got some positive momentum there.
So maybe we can ask and we can take a vote on it. Could we request that we get a kind of a job role and description? Because I think when it first was brought up, most people felt that it was going to be like the person that the patients would contact. And if that's not the case, we wonder what will their role be? How will it differ than the patient advocate, the ombudsman, Tara Morgan, who is now at ASH and acts as the patient ombudsman. I know that was a whole bunch along with the motion, call for a motion.
Yeah, no problem. I'd be happy to secure the job description of this individual and how they're going to work within the hospital.
I'd like to point out the very definition, dictionary definition of an ombudsman is somebody who hears and investigates complaints from private citizens against governmental officials or administrators or employees of a company against the administration of that company. It doesn't seem that the word ombudsman, as you're describing it, Larry, applies to the person that's going to be taking this job. Maybe some other name could be given to him, because he's certainly not going to be an ombudsman in the sense, the dictionary sense of that word, if he's not investigating and facilitating complaints from people involved, which in this case are the people who are in the forensic and civil units of this Arizona State Hospital and the administration. So I'm not sure that the word ombudsman actually applies. So please clarify.
Yes, I can certainly get the, I don't have the job description. I have never seen it. So, you know, I'm just letting the committee know that the ombudsman has been hired. Now, I'm not too sure on the job description and what it's going to entail, but I was told that, or at least what I remember from the last meeting, that that it's not going to be patient related, but I might be wrong. I could certainly get the job description and get that back out to the committee. So you'll have an idea of what to expect from this individual.
Thanks.
No problem, Dr. Goldstein.
Okay. So do we need to take a vote on that, Larry, or you're just going to send us the job description?
No, I can send that to you.
Okay.
I'll send it to everybody.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Updates from other IOCs. Crystal, I see you're on. Do you have anything from the DD IOC?
Let me think. Not really. I can't think of anything. At least at this point.
Okay. Thank you. Always good to have you on.
Thank you.
Any other IOC members on that would like to give an update? Okay, review of action items. All of them follow up on previous discussions. The only one, and something else popped in my head, but I didn't write it down and it's gone. But one thing was, based on some patient visits, I know that Alice and Barb did maybe a month and a half ago-ish, maybe more. They were going to write up a document because they didn't want to discuss the complaints in detail. They did at a high level. And at this point, we don't have that document. I know Barb said that she has that information that she'll share with the executive in executive session today. But other than that, I'm trying to think if there was anything else. Any other committee members think, can you think of anything else that was ongoing that we left?
I think we were discussing risk assessment, but we've gotten updates from the hospital on that. I don't know if we should discuss it here or not, or we need to.
Yeah, I think, if I recall, Mike Sheldon sent out, didn't you send us what the risk assessment, which was reasonable on, you know, you have to be med compliant, you have to be participating in your therapy, kind of basics, before they will invest in a risk assessment. Since they have limited resources, it didn't make sense to the team to just every time someone asked for a risk assessment to get it, if even the clinical team wasn't going to recommend that the person progress. But Mike, did I capture that right?
Yeah, 100%. And that was a while ago, so I am pretty sure I did send you all that document. If I didn't, I apologize, and I'll get it over to you ASAP.
I didn't get a copy, Mike.
I did send it, Lori, right? I'm not imagining this.
You did, but Kay can't get email.
Okay.
So I think we need to get Kay copies of the meeting minutes and then anything that we send out.
Yeah, that's our fault. We'll make sure Trevor or Tara gets Kay the minutes and the that document.
Thank you.
Okay. Mike, do you have any other update from the hospital administration?
Happy New Year, everybody. So the only real updates I have is that we're still actively in recruitment for some pretty high level positions, including our chief medical officer and our director of human resources at the hospital. So those positions are posted. And if anyone on the IOC is interested in seeing it, At the end of December, the hospital posted its 2024 fiscal year annual report to the department's website. It's up there for your review and download if you want to take a look at it. It's got some pretty interesting stuff in there showing a lot of the improvements that we're making and the numbers that we're seeing. So very proud of what we've been accomplishing, and that report I think does a good job of showing where we are, where we've been, and where we're going. That's all I have.
Okay, in there, is there any mention of areas that you would like to expand if funding comes with those requests?
Yeah, exactly. So we did add a section at the end with some recent like notable achievements and some potential options for moving forward that would benefit the hospital and the citizens of the state.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Oh, okay. As far as patient visits, some of the things that have come up since the last meeting, one was a safety concern by a patient. And when they wanted to come to the IOC, my response, I think what Chuck was on with me, is that they first have to voice that concern to the clinical team or the unit PM, so the hospital has the opportunity to, one, hear the complaint and react to the complaint, the safety concern, before really escalating to us. I don't know what the rest of the team members feel, but I thought that it's hard if someone comes straight to the IOC without going, at least letting someone in administration or the team know that they felt unsafe. And I think that they went back and did that. And from what I've heard, that they were moved to alleviate that safety concern. Any questions on that?
Yeah, Lori, I'm going to answer the question, but I presume the safety concern, it wasn't, it didn't have anything to do, I suppose, with like staff or anyone that they might end up telling. So that was not a conflict, right?
Right. It was another patient.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. And I get, see what you're getting. If the patient is in fear or has safety concerns and they're concerned from the staff, then it would be hard to say to that staff. I don't know, Mike, what's the procedure for that? Do they call Tara?
They can always reach out to Tara. They can file a complaint stating they like to be moved off of to a different unit, and then we'll take that under consideration. Tara will go meet with the individual, and then we'll engage from that perspective. So there are avenues for that individual to state their concern without speaking directly to somebody on that unit or the staff member in question.
Thank you. The other one that was a little bit unusual. Oh, good. We have Jane here now, and hopefully Janina will be on shortly. But in this the other situation, there was a concern because of a safety protocol and procedure to make sure that the hospital remains a safe environment and that it's drug-free. And because of that, there were some inspections and some searches, and some of the patients felt that their rights were being violated. Again, I think the details of which are, if the hospital or staff have reason to believe that someone is bringing drugs or weapons or whatever that could be harmful to the patient or other patients or the environment, that I think as an entity, they have to follow certain procedures like they would in any hospital. And I think that's as much as I can say without revealing too much. But I think that, Mike, if you want to add anything.
No, I think you stated it perfectly, Lori. If we have a reason or a suspicion to believe that we have some illicit activity going on, we have a responsibility to interject and ensure the safety and security of the overall facility. And when we do searches of the kind that you're speaking about, it is only done under the order of a doctor asking to have it done. So it's not something that we take lightly. We do have policies and protocols in place to make sure that a specific chain of command is followed. So we are checking the boxes appropriately in matters like this.
Okay. Thank you for that. Other than that, anything else from the committee before we go into some overview of incident and accidents?
I have one quick thing. Mike, when I get that checklist, is that for my own personal use as an IOC member, or am I able to distribute that to the patient?
Oh, yeah, no, you can definitely distribute it, Kay. So Trevor, Tara, can you do me a favor and print out like 10 copies of it and just kind of distribute it across the forensic campus so Kay doesn't need to go to Kinko's or anything like that?
I will do it.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Tara. Okay, first thing I was going to talk about, and I'm looking at my other monitor, so sorry. In the assault perpetrators, we had, again, just one patient that was pretty assaultive. They had 7 incidents, and after that, we had 3 that had 3 instances, and then we had 4 that had 2, and then about 6 that had 1. So it's what we have seen. I think the numbers of assaults by a particular patient seem to have gone down since, if I recall correctly, the patient, since I don't know the names, that had some, I think, cognitive decline and cognitive issues have now been moved to a more appropriate setting. Is that correct, Mike?
Yeah. And that was not recent. Specific individuals that you're referring to actually discharged about 15 or 16 months ago, but we have seen a noticeable downward trend for assaults, for seclusion restraints across the facility. And that is also mentioned in the annual report that I spoke of a few minutes ago.
Thank you. One quick question. So I know that not all the counties, Maricopa in particular, send a lot of their patients to restore to competency to the hospital. Some of them keep them in jails and do their own program. But when you have patients that are there for restoration, or if they're non-restorable and dangerous, do those patients tend to have high assaultive behavior?
It's dependent. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. The individuals who are sent to us for restoration services almost always come in from outlying counties, where in Arizona, most of the counties do restoration services in their county jails. They have in-house psychiatrists to do that work. So we typically get restoration patients from the outlying, more rural areas of the state, Santa Cruz, Graham, counties like that, Mojave. So when they do come to us, the restoration cases, they're typically not hyper assaultive, but they are quite sick when they come in because they have not been properly treated for their mental illness prior to coming to us. The individuals, though, that have been deemed non-restorable, those folks typically come to us under a civil commitment order. And yes, those individuals tend to be more active on that front. It can be because of a number of reasons. Typically, if someone is deemed non-restorable, it's because of something outside of a psychiatric issue. It's no cognitive disorder, it's dementia, traumatic brain injury, things like that. But so yeah, they do have a tendency to be a little bit more on the higher end of the aggression scale.
Do you have the luxury of putting them in a place that separates them from the regular civil patients or the regular forensic patients, or do you have to intermingle?
Unfortunately, we're in a situation right now where we don't have the luxury of isolating patient groups like that. We're pretty much operating at capacity. So anybody that we get, we just try to get up, make sure we have a bed available to put them in. So introducing somebody like that to the general milieu is and can be and most often is detrimental to the care for the rest of the population that we treat.
Mike, how many of your population are the people who are found or that you're holding to try to restore competency?
Yeah, so right now, Dr. Goldstein members, I believe there are three current patients on the forensic hospital who are here specifically under Rule 11 for restoration services. And typically our restoration cases stay with us for about 90 to 120 days before we restore them and send them back to the county for trial. The individuals, I can't give you an exact number for the folks that are under Title 36 civil and have a incompetent to stand trial, you know, background. I would say right now it's probably about a handful that we have.
That's what I would expect. And to answer your question, Mark, these people that are not competent to stand trial, not competent because they failed at one of two points of law, I guess you would call it, or competencies. And one is that they understand the charges against them, and the other that they are felt by the judge to be able to assist in their own defense, work with their defense attorney. So if they fail at either one of those two, that makes them incompetent to stand trial. But because that's a legal point, it does not go to the character of the person. So I would not expect these people to be either more dangerous or less dangerous than the general population. So they're not usually any more violent than you would expect from the general population.
Okay, I just wondered.
Yeah.
But what about the classification of people that are non-restorable, can't stand trial, and they're deemed dangerous? They go through that other, I'm talking about those people. Well,
That's a different case, because those people are already adjudged to be dangerous. So you would expect them to be violent. You know?
Okay. Anyway. Okay, we'll start with a few incidents and accidents that looked a bit unusual. One was Ash 2024-3946, and it was assault sexual staff conduct, which is unethical, unprofessional, immoral, or abusive to patients or staff or visitors. The way that was written, I thought it was staff and sexual abuse, but reading through it, I don't think it was. I think it was one patient that was acting inappropriately with another patient. And let me see. Because in here, they're talking and the patient saying they didn't hit him, but one patient inappropriately touched another patient. Wasn't really clear why.
What number was this, Lori? I'm sorry.
It was 3946. It seemed like it was between two patients, so I don't know why there was an unprofessional, immoral, abusive to patients that tagged on to the description.
I just reviewed. I think that whoever submitted the IR selected something in error and my team did not correct it, but you are absolutely correct. It did not involve a staff member. It was between two patients. So I will get that corrected now. I appreciate you bringing it to our attention.
Thank you. Okay. Because I was looking and it just seemed like it was two patients and not staff. Next one was 3947. And this one had to do with a patient that was saying certain things and being very confronted. They were confronting staff. And when the RN asked the person to stop and to de-escalate and they're trying to, then that the patient was told that they were going to be ROU for threatening staff. And at that point, then the patient started punching that same person and a radio went flying. But the notes were saying that when telling a patient that they're going to be ROU for behavior, make sure that they're not in range to be assaulted. I would think by that point, you'd call a code. And it did seem like they called a code gray, but it seems like that was after they started escalating and starting to get physical.
Lori, members, as we've discussed several times in this venue and others, our initial action is verbal de-escalation. We want to make sure we do that. Some individuals in this situation may have called a code earlier than what happened in this specific case. It all comes down to the relationship the staff member has with the patient. Some of them have really, really good rapport and they know how to talk the patient down. Others, not so much. It's a very kind of fine line they walk.
Okay. The next one was 3978, and that was a medical alert. And with this one, a patient was found in the bathroom having had a seizure. So a medical alert, and then they were sent out. A question just for making sure that if they are just now starting to have seizures, and if that's not something that can be addressed, what's the protocol so that, you know, there's a fine line between letting them have their privacy in the restroom, and then there's the other side of, and then finding them having seizures on the floor in the restroom. So how do you balance that once you know someone's had a seizure or tends to have seizures?
So it's very similar to the folks that we would determine as being high fall risks. So if someone, you know, falls repeatedly or has a well-documented ongoing history of seizures, we may put them on a one-to-one to ensure their safety, to make sure someone is within reach to potentially catch them if they start to fall or to assist them if they begin to seize. I don't believe, though, that this individual has that history, though.
Okay. Yeah. Well, they'll just have to figure out why they had the seizure.
Right. So we'll send them across the street. They may do a neurology workup on them, see if it's anything that we need to be concerned about, see if it's, you know, medication related, whatever it may be. And then we'll reassess their risk and then decide how to proceed from that review.
Jane, you had a question or a comment?
Yeah, I have a follow-up question. Michael, I'm just curious. So is that what you did in this case? Did you refer this individual for a neurological workup as part of the aftercare?
On the top of my head, I can't answer that question right now, Jane. I haven't gone through all the notes to see what happened with this. It would not necessarily be us referring for a neurological assessment. It would be the physician at Valleywise making that referral. if he or she feels is necessary based on the patient's condition. I do not, I haven't had a chance to review all the notes to see what this individual was assessed for.
I can jump in here. Yes, this patient was referred for neurological consult, and that has already taken place.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Okay, the next one is 3999. And this one is an assault, patient threatening staff, staff conduct, which is unethical, unprofessional, immoral, abusive to patients, staff, or visitors. So in this situation, a code gray was called, and the patient was put in a physical hold with multiple staff in a seclusion room with the patient, and the patient continued to spit towards staff. Then they got a spit mask. I didn't know you guys had those, and placed over the patient's face. But a BHT later identified was holding the patient and began an exchange of words with the patient. And they appeared that BHT was pretty upset with having gotten spit upon and having a struggle. So they were responding in an inappropriate manner towards the patient in an escalated tone, which then caused the patient to escalate. The patient was, they were in a back and forth in an aggressive manner. And the other person, whoever's writing this, recognized that BHT was upset and offered to just step in and take over and ask them to kind of move out. So that was good that this person writing saw that this was not a healthy interaction with the staff towards the patient. It was escalating, and it was a shift commander, maybe?
Yeah, that's the security officer who wrote the incident report. The individual in question is no longer with the hospital.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I know we've been frustrated before when we saw staff acting in ways we didn't think was therapeutic, but at the bottom line, after this went to review, it said, following an investigation, it was determined that BHT is designed to do not return. Mm-hmm. And it was made in alignment with their hospital policies and procedures. My question is, was this a traveling nurse or a registry?
Yes.
Not nurse, tech? Okay.
Yep.
And was that why it was so easy to say that this person can't come back?
Yes.
Okay. I just wondered. Okay. I assume it's harder if an employee is acting in that manner. But right. I was glad to see that it was immediately acted upon. Too bad Alice wasn't here. She'd be very happy. So, okay, let me see this one. This one, next one is 4028, and it was an attempted suicide. So for this, it's on 12-12, December 12th. And the suicide, the patient was voicing concerns about harming themselves and that they wanted to die. And then the patient grabbed the phone cord and quickly wrapped it around their neck, not loosely, not tight. And when that happened, a code gray was called. The patient was put into a restraint chair, taken back to the seclusion room. In the medical notes, it said that patient was admitted to the state hospital while still under one-on-one staff at a previous psych facility due to self-harm. And she's on COS and LOS and had been during the above incident with the phone cord. In addition, the patient has to have a sterile room, no objects smaller than her fist, wear a jumpsuit, only finger foods with no utensils, and they have a behavioral health plan with privileges and rewards. It's been effective in cases like this. So I know line of sight means I have to see them. And COS is what again?
Is that 3 feet or 6 feet, Trevor?
It depends on the type of COS LOS they're on, but in this case for DTO or DTS behaviors, it's 3 feet. That's correct.
Okay.
And then just for clarification, so the committee knows, our phone cords are only 12 inches long. So this was not a situation where the person could wrap it around their neck multiple times. There was, it's a ligature resistant phone. So it was more of a, not a suicide attempt versus kind of making the, say it again, Trevor?
A suicide gesture.
There you go. Yeah, exactly.
We just don't have ability to code that way yet, but one day.
Okay. And so the next one, 4036, was the same ID, patient ID. Again, it was attempted suicide. It was, I'm trying to look at times. One of them has a time, but it was like a day later. And the same patient was in the day room by the phone. When they appeared, they were on the phone. And then they used the phone and used the phone to start banging the head upon the phone. And it was the same one that was trying to harm themselves with the phone cord. At that time, a medical alert was called and the patient was sent to the hospital with a one-on-one. So they must have, if I go down to the nursing notes, it said someone noticed the cord was wrapped around the neck after they removed the phone cord, and they placed it in a BPH. They placed her, it's all in code here, and they appeared to pass out. So a medical code was called, and the
BPH is brief physical hold.
Okay. Then they appeared to pass out. Medical code called. Medical on-call doc was on the unit within a minute, and they took the vitals BP 120 over 74, HR 116, oxygen 97%. They called 911 and they sent the patient to the hospital. But what was interesting is they said that the patient was using the bang their head on the phone, and then in the notes it said they were wrapping the cord. But they, while this was happening, the patient also tried to hurt themselves with the phone cord. So in this case, what do you do if the patient continues, even if they're on COS and LOS? Do they have to stay away from the phone or something? So I mean, I don't know what you do.
We definitely don't want to do anything that would prohibit the patient from contacting, you know, friends, family, guardians, legal counsel, whatever it may be. But with someone like that, who's doing things like this, if it's DTS behavior like this, it would be most likely, obviously, assuring their immediate safety, their immediate medical wellness, which is why I think they went to ValleyWise in this case. But it may be something, if it doesn't elevate to where it is right now, that would be a situation where we would look at potentially restraining the individual to make sure they can't self-harm or do any kind of physical self-injurious behavior. But we really, and we want to make sure that we do that only as and when needed. That's kind of like that last resort that we want to go to.
Okay. The last one that stood out to me was 4228. And this was patient refusing redirection, self-abuse, self-injury, significant physical changes in a patient, other significant irregular events. So the first thing that says is urgent KUB ordered, incident involving code gray and sent to ValleyWise emergency room. So I had no idea what KUB means.
Trevor, Dr. Goldstein, I don't know that either.
It's abdominal pain. They were sending her out to have things checked in her abdomen. And you'll see why as you read through the rest of the IR. I don't know what the acronym stands for.
That's what I thought too.
Is this an X-ray, Lori?
No, this is a patient. And the first thing says urgent KUB ordered.
Okay. Yeah, that's an abdominal X-ray.
Okay.
Okay. So the patient, as you read down, I just didn't know what KUB. The patient, as you read down, they complained of 10 out of 10 on a pain scale in their abdominal. And they described it as deep shooting and stabbing. They had already had some medication from the nurse, Tylenol. Provider was notified and they referred an order for an urgent KUB. They went to the appointment for that urgent KUB and came back, and it was reported that they didn't find anything. So the patient was asking, well, what now? Because she still had, the patient still had 10 out of 10. And they were trying to walk them through what was going to happen. At that point, I don't know whether it was atypical or not, but her COS staff witnessed the patient breaking off the right temple of their glasses, long piece that goes over the ear, at the hinge point, swallowing it, and the screw connecting to the temple, to the rim, was found to not have been swallowed, but was discarded out of their reach. They were escorted, and they were still complaining, 10 out of 10. And the provider was called back. There's orders now for behavior plans, sterile room, jumpsuit, nothing smaller than a fist. And they tried to view everything prior to being transported to Valleywise. So on this, what happens? I mean, again, this is not my domain, but if someone's breaking their glasses and swallowing, you want them to be able to see, but how do you mitigate that so they don't self-harm? Can they do goggles, maybe?
So, you know, I don't know if we have goggles or not. I think the hope is that the one-to-one can intervene as quickly as possible, which is what our staff are trained to do. Unfortunately, this particular patient was rather fast. And so even though they were only 3 feet away, this patient was able to do that. But there are things, again, such as a sterile room, being in a jumpsuit. If needed, they could be put in mitts or have a helmet on, different things of that nature.
I know there's goggles for scuba that have prescription, and I imagine those are a lot more expensive than prescription glasses. I don't know what other alternatives there are.
I don't know. So are there any questions about from the committee or any comments over any of the instances that I brought up?
No.
Okay.
I'm just a little stumped. Swallowing arm of the glasses, it's got a different name. How does one swallow that? Was it swallowed entirely?
I do know, and I mean, Chuck can speak to this too, people that want to swallow, you'll turn your back, and Crystal has worked as a site nurse, they can swallow a spoon faster than you can. Right, Crystal?
Yes, I've had people swallow their dentures. I've had people swallow a lock. I've had people swallow just things that you'd never think possible. So, and they are fast. They are extremely fast.
Yeah. No. Thank you.
Jane, you had your hand up.
Oh,
I did. I'm just curious. So for the outcomes, once the incident occurs, and then there's intervention that takes place, then in every case that we discussed, was that individual brought back to the hospital with kind of the interventions that you described? Were there any of these cases that resulted in a removal from or a transfer from the hospital?
So in these particular incidents, these patients all returned fairly quickly. As far as were some of the interventions that we discussed implemented upon their return from ValleyWise, the answer would be yes.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, in addition to these incidents, we were given a patients, more than one, had mailed off correspondence to Larry at the IOC to pass on to the committee. There is a concern, and there were grievances and complaints filed with the allegation that reducing patients' work in the therapeutic work program to save money is unethical and unacceptable. And they're talking about the therapeutic work program is anticipated to undergo changes that will include setting standards and expectations. Once those changes are in place, the amount of work hours that the participants are able to utilize per week will be revisited. So, Mike, as far as the work program, is it the provider not going to provide enough hours, or is it going to be based on if patients are adhering to plans, or what's the reason patients are getting their work hours reduced?
So it's a little bit of all the above. I think the last time this group met, this issue had come up. I had recently just announced the change to the program. So it is a matter of funding. So we do pay the patient's minimum wage to work in that program. So the provider in this case is actually the state hospital. So we want to look at this program to make sure that we're maximizing our funds, and that the hospital as well as the patient are truly benefiting from the program. So the patients are learning skills that are going to help them once they discharge from the hospital. And it's meaningful and appropriate and is in alignment with their treatment goals. So therapeutic work program, just so we're kind of on the same page, is not a right. It is an earned privilege. So I want to just make sure everybody understands that we're not violating anybody's rights in this situation. We're under no obligation to provide this program. It's entirely based on funding and based on the appropriateness and necessity to help the patients. So that being said, yesterday, Trevor's team did host a focus group with 9 or 10 forensic patients to get their feedback and input about how the program could possibly be transformed in the future, looking for things like criteria to be put into the program, what types of opportunities should be in that program, and kind of rules around it. The last time this group met, I think I made a comment along the lines of, we really want to make it seem appear to be a real world kind of job scenario, right? Where the patients need to be on good behavior to participate in this program, to earn the right to be in that program. And if the patients, you know, do not participate in treatment, are aggressive, assaultive, then they should be fired from the program, just like any of us would be in the real world. So that's where we're heading with this. Hopefully, I'll have in the next week and a half or so, some tangible recommendations that come out of that focus group. And then I'll sit down with the rehab team and we will go from there.
So in the outside world, when people have diagnosed SMI and they're in a supported employment, if they're symptomatic or if they're, you know, for whatever reason, under stress, certain behaviors come out or whatever, usually their coaches will help. And if they're having racing thoughts or whatever their issue and they need to leave work, they're pretty accommodating with that. Is that, I mean, I know it's a fine line between willfully acting out, or is this a sign of, are you having symptoms of your mental illness? So are they going to adjust for that like they do in the supported employment in the outside world?
Yes, Lori. So it's not so much a, if someone is, you know, if someone is responding to internal stimuli, symptomatic of their mental illness, you know, that individual, first of all, most likely would not be participating in the work program at that point in time. But they will obviously take that into consideration. If it's a result of a stressor from their psychosis versus a behavioral outburst, then yes, they will take that into consideration.
Okay, thank you. Okay, anything else from the committee before? Now, we also have an executive session, but the way it goes is that we, this is still the main session. If you have anything else to discuss before we go to public comment, after public comment, we will adjourn and go to executive session. And I'll put, Larry sent that out, but if you need the executive session, I'll put it in the chat. We go to executive session to discuss the items that Barb and Alice wanted to discuss from some of their patient visits, and then we adjourn out of that, come back to this meeting and adjourn.
Okay, do you have the phone number? Do you have the phone
yes.
number and the extension? Okay,
yes.
What is that?
So it's dial 1-470-268-2393. And the PIN?
Yes.
Is 248-057-653-pound.
Okay. I think it's 470-268-2393. PIN is 248-057-653-pound.
Pound, yes.
Okay.
Jane?
Yeah, one final question in just processing the information that was shared with us regarding the incidents. For those patients that had the more aggressive intervention in terms of being put into a suit and having the one-on-one interactions, could you give us an idea of what is the average length of time that is appropriate, and then are there changes in medication, or what's the strategy then to reintegrate that person back into the normal population with the normal kind of conditions of residency?
Hey Jane, so it's entirely dependent on the individual and the behaviors that they're exhibiting. Typically, if somebody goes into, say, like a jumpsuit, that is not something where they're in it for, you know, 5 hours or whatever. This it could be days, it could be weeks, as long until our medical staff is confident that the person can be, that we should attempt to kind of reintegrate them. And that's not a great word to use, because they're still within the general population of the hospital. They're around other patients. They're just in specific clothing.
Okay.
So it is very dependent on their behaviors and the interactions that they have with the staff and with other patients. And your question about medication changes, that is constant and continuous for all patients, not just individuals. In this situation, we're always reassessing if the medications appropriate to address the psychosis of our folks. So we're always looking at potential medication changes that may be necessary to help these folks out.
Thank you.
Anything else from the committee before we go to public comment and then executive session and then back to public? Crystal?
So I didn't know if this was public or if it's part of the committee, but kind of back to the non-restorable, the individuals that would have been forensic had they been able to like go through the process. I'm not sure that there isn't more than that, unless there's been a lot of discharges over the last few years. If you go like way back in some of our longtime patients. But the other thing I kind of wanted to mention about the non-restorable individuals that are on the civil side, I never saw a difference in their dangerousness and stuff so much, but what there is a difference is the length of stay and the ability to discharge. So that's my concern, is if we continue to accept people that are in that criminal realm onto the civil side, it's going to be a forensic hospital all the way around. It's going to be the forensic side, and then it's going to be the non-restorable side. It's not going to have civil beds just because it's so difficult to discharge unless we can get those secure perfs or some kind of a different setup for them. So maybe we can get, I don't know if somebody could go back in those charts and actually get a solid number of how many people are at the hospital that went through the criminal system first and then were just non-restorable. I mean, I'm even thinking back to the individuals that were there and are my age, like 60s.
So two comments first. Yeah. One, Crystal is a IOC member, so we can speak.
Okay.
And she can participate. Number two is that Crystal is a psych nurse, and she was at Arizona State Hospital working there for 30 years. She no longer works there. She works at another facility. So when she refers back to when she actually worked there for a long time.
Yeah. So it was a long time ago, and my numbers could be off. But again, I'd be interested if, and again, I can't really make a motion or anything, but if the committee would consider, and I know you can't answer, well, you might be able to answer me, about getting that number that might have gone through the criminal system first or are it's still in the hospital, and then also considering the fact that those individuals' length of stay and ability to discharge could, in the future, if this is the way the courts are going to do it, this could become just a forensic hospital with no civil beds. And I know that would take a while, but that's a fear of mine.
I think that we asked this question in the past, if I remember correctly, we asked Michael to estimate how many people were in that category you're talking about, non-restorable and on the civil side. I'm not sure whether they came through a Title 13 or Title 36, but they're non-restorable, and they're kind of like inhabiting the Arizona State Hospital. They're living there. And I thought right. I told him, Michael, that was about 15 to 20 patients.
That's probably a close estimate, Dr. Goldstein. That's not something that we readily track because they're under a civil commitment order. So we don't have a designation like in our health record that would say this person has, you know, this kind of designation as incompetent to stand trial in the past. And I think what Crystal said is very important. There are other states in the country that are actually getting sued right now because of situations like this, where they've had to sacrifice civil beds to take on the incompetent stand trial, non-restorable population. So there's a very kind of small slice of resources, and everyone is pulling to try to get a little bit of it. And if for one population to grow, another one organically needs to, it's a zero-sum game, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Well, we do have 94 acres, right, or 93 acres, and a lot of land. If it's really important to the county prosecutors and the judicial system, and they really want a place for people to stay for a long period of time, they should utilize and fund another building. I mean, it's not right. We have the fewest number of civil beds in the country. We don't need to be filling them up with people that we know will stay there probably for the rest of their life and take away those scarce few. We have one bed per 100,000. And you should have 50 to 60 per 100,000. So we don't need to lose any more beds.
Yeah.
But
I was under the impression that this had been discussed and that there was some movement to move these non-competent, non-restorable patients to other facilities. Is that incorrect, Michael? Was it?
I guess it depends on their medical status. So they may be, if we can no longer provide care for them because of like increased medical needs, then they may be transferred to a skilled nursing facility for ongoing care. But even those beds are really limited. They got to get qualified for all techs, which everyone knows is very difficult to do. So yeah, we do have limited options, but it's very difficult to do that.
So I think the takeaway is that we should try to advocate at the legislature and mm-hmm. at the governor's office, because I understand there's a problem that the county prosecutors want a place to send people that they have deemed non-restorable dangerous. And in some instances, I think they've just let them out, but now they want them to go somewhere. But again, we need a better solution. Jane?
Yeah, I want to tag team a little bit with Crystal's thought, because I heard her say, you know, is it appropriate to make a motion? And I'm wondering, do we have is the information that we received right now on the number of patients that fit this criteria, do we need a motion to make sure that we get a precise count, and then to understand of that count how many ultimately get transferred to a skilled nursing facility, and under what conditions they are transferred?
So the problem, Jane, is that once they become non-restorable, they change it to Title 36. So like what Mr. Sheldon was saying, it's hard to track it. So I know of patients that were probably admitted in the 1990s to 2000s that I don't know if they could adequately track. I know that they've done a really violent crime and they likely went through the criminal justice system, but they've been Title 36 for so long now. I don't know how much of that history is, you know, in the chart. I could be wrong. I don't know if somebody else wants to answer that, but
from my experience, Crystal, that's an accurate statement.
But I do think it wouldn't be, I do think right now there's two conflicting bills. One of them is from like, I think the state or somebody else that they're gonna allow ASH to be basically the dumping ground. I don't wanna say dumping ground, because all the patients deserve care in a hospital, but it's gonna be, they're gonna use ASH for this. And then there's another bill out there that says that the two can't be mixed. So there's two conflicting bills right now that it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. If we could get them where they can't be mixed, what do you think? So this is my question. What do you think about opening the top floor of Ironwood for non-restorable individuals?
Well,
that's still the civil campus. So
So you still couldn't mix them?
Right.
And the other thing, Crystal, the whole reason for the separation of populations for the SBIRFs is that it's a whole different ballgame when you have a hospital, whether it's the Arizona State Hospital or Valley Wise or any hospital where you have some patient that is acting out, you have a show of force. If you have in a residential setting, whether it's a birth or whether it's a secure birth, which means it has a nice gate yard and area, you don't have staff. You don't have that kind of staff. You have one or two behavioral techs. You have no real security. If they're dangerous and violent in a hospital, the hospital can react. If they're in a residential setting and they're assaulting people all the time, I don't see how that works. So I think the providers don't want to provide to people that just need time where they can't leave while they get their medications take effect and their therapy takes effect so they can step down to a non-secure versus people that might have to live out their life and may act out.
Right. Okay. Thank you for your time.
Yeah. Thanks. Any other comments on that? So remember, go down to the legislature when their bills are being heard. It's important.
Good reminder.
Yes. Okay. So any other discussion before we go to open public forum, public comment? And remember, for public comment, we're not the treatment team, so we're not addressing your specific treatment. If you want to bring up an issue, whether it's unit safety or lack of particular treatment that you feel that you should be getting, things like that as a group, but not your specific treatment, that's the right forum to bring it up. And also, we're not here to, I mean, it's not a forum to discuss that you don't like your doctor or your nurse, those kinds of specific details. And with that, are we going to open for public comment? Okay, do we have anyone from the public that would like to make a comment? Quiet tonight. So anyone that isn't part of the IOC, if you'd like to say anything or any of the patients that are on, this is the opportunity to talk during public comment, remembering we cannot respond, we can just listen. Okay, hearing none, I guess we can go to our executive session. We will see you in about a minute in the executive session. Thank you, everyone. Thanks for joining our IOC.
Thanks, Lori. Thanks. Bye-bye.
We're trickling in. Okay, Barb and Kim.
Yeah, I think we're just waiting on Kay to come back. And here she comes.
And hopefully Barb and Kim also, but we have quorum, so we could welcome yes. everyone back to the Arizona State Hospital. Yeah. Hi, Kim. We just are coming out of executive session, and we do have a few things to vote on. One, we have a motion to get some follow-up on what are the approved noise-canceling headphones and blue light glasses for patients that have had some of that type of equipment confiscated. So we do want that. Do I have a...
What is the motion, Lori?
The motion is we want a list of noise-canceling headphones and blue light glasses that are approved. And that list provided to us and to the patients.
I make a motion.
Okay.
I second the motion.
Okay.
And I
all in favor?
May I make a recommendation, Lori? Yeah. Could sure. Because I know this is an issue that's been aging for a couple yeah. of months. Could we say that within 14 days, can we add that to our motion that we'll get that list? Within 14.
Larry, can we put a time restriction?
On the response?
Yes.
I'm sorry. Yeah, the time restriction is 21 days.
Very good.
Okay.
So you should have a response back before your next meeting.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Motion passes. The second one, we wanted the hospital to provide their policy and their process for non-indigent patients that may owe money for prepaid medications / or services. What is that process, and has that been explained to the patients, and can we see those processes? That's a mess of a motion.
The motion more concisely is we make a motion that the hospital provide us with their process for recovering funds from patients that have the means to have funds, and exactly what that entails and how they go about informing the patients that they are doing this.
Okay. Do we have a second?
I second.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. So that motion passes. Do we have any other motions from executive session that we'd like to propose?
Not that I remember.
I thought there was one more.
Yeah, I thought so too, but I didn't remember.
It was with the second to the last or the last patient. And it was...
No, the complimentary...
Well,
was there any was there desire to understand what complementary
and alternative
medicines are acceptable on the campus?
I would phrase that as a motion. I think people would clarify things.
Okay.
The state the motion.
Tell us that we get information on what complementary and alternative methods are available, and at what, which, if any, can be done or have or can be had at this at ASH. That was my motion.
Okay. Do I have a second?
I second.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay. And with that, I think we're about to call for adjournment.
Motion to adjourn.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you guys for all your hard work.
Thank you too, Lori.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, everybody.
Bye.
Bye-bye.